Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is one of the original underground cartoonists who started publishing over half a century ago. He's the author of a number of books, including Invisible Ink, Are We Having Fun Yet?, and Nobody's Fool. And his daily comic strip, Zippy the Pinhead, runs in dozens of daily newspapers. Bill Griffith, it's an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio today.
Likewise.
Well, tell us about your new book, your graphic novel, Nobody's Fool. It's subtitled The Life and Times of Schlitzie the Pinhead. Sounds very similar to Zippy the Pinhead.
Yeah, well, this is me acknowledging the inspiration for Zippy in a biography, a book that's been kind of percolating on the back burner for more than 50 years. People know Schlitzie sometimes through the movie Freaks, the 1932 Todd Browning movie. Schlitzie had a few scenes in there. I saw that movie in 1963 at the age of 19 when I was going to art school in New York, and it rearranged my molecules. I remember coming back to my apartment in Brooklyn and thinking, I was just given this huge input. I have to do something with it artistically, but I was not a cartoonist at the time. I thought I was going to be a painter, which I did try for about 7 years. But when I did become a cartoonist in 1968, 69, Schlitzie then resurfaced in my memory from that movie. And in 1970, I did the first Zippy strip based on one postcard I had of Schlitzie. So Zippy looked just like Schlitzie.
Even dressed like Schlitzie.
He even dressed like Schlitzie in his signature muumuu. And he had his head shaved with just eight hairs and a bow, tying his eight hairs together on a tuft. So that's Schlitzie. The Schlitzie is the inspiration for Zippy.
And Schlitzie, the clinical term for pinheads, as they were called back in the sideshows of the early 20th century, was microcephalic.
Yes.
And in the case of Schlitzie, he was bought at the age of eight by a sideshow impresario.
Yes. Yes. I consulted a genealogist and I could get no absolute proof of his name or exact birth date. But I did know from his death certificate that he was born in the Bronx in 1901. He was born with microcephaly. There's a spectrum that goes with any mental handicap or abnormality. He was kind of on the high-functioning level. So Schlitzie, even with his limitations, was a person. And that was what I wanted to bring out with this book. I wanted to humanize him, to take him off the sideshow stage, which I depicted plenty of, because that was his life. But I wanted to also show him off the sideshow stage. What was he really like?
Right. In the book, he finds a community with these other sideshow performers, and people who haven't seen Todd Browning's Freaks might assume that it's an exploitation film, but really the theme running through it is about this community and this support and this dignity that's given to all these performers. And your book really points that up. It takes that community in the lead up to the filming of Browning's movie.
Yeah, the question that the movie poses is, who are the real freaks? And the answer is the audience, not the performers. Todd Browning himself was a sideshow performer. He started out at the age of 16. He ran away with the circus in St. Louis, Missouri in some 1910 or something. And he was a contortionist. He did a wild man from Borneo act. He did a very weird act where he buried himself in 6 feet of dirt with a straw sticking out of his mouth. He was fed malted milk balls. So that was one of his acts. He knew all of the performers in Freaks through his sideshow days. He specifically requested Schlitzie be cast in the movie Freaks.
Right. You pieced together all this information that you were able to cobble from various sources into a biography, a graphic biography. And obviously, people didn't think enough of these performers back then to keep really detailed records, but what you did find was really surprising.
Well, this book took about 3 years to do, and all during that time I was doing research. I could have done the book without the internet, but it wouldn't have been as rich. It wouldn't have had so much detail. I did take the journalist's credo of corroborate whatever you hear, or if I thought what I was depicting was unsubstantiated, I did say it in the book. Because, of course, you have to remember, this was the circus sideshow, which thrives on exaggeration and untruth and, you know, downright lies. Schlitzy was usually billed as a female, first of all. So he was a male billed as a female. That was considered freakier. In other words, if someone had a mental or physical abnormality and they were female, the audience was more offended, therefore more excited to see it. He really didn't have much of an act. He was exhibited more than he was a performer. He would stand on the stage accompanied by a guy who they called the talker. And the talker would spiel this long fictional story about where Schlitzy was from, that he only ate grasshoppers and swamp grass, his brain was the size of a walnut or a golf ball, et cetera, et cetera. And Schlitzy just sort of sat there sweetly and benignly and smiled.
And one of the appeals of Schlitzy, the pinhead, being on stage was that he'd sometimes make random pronouncements.
Yes.
And this is something that definitely found its way into your Zippy strips. Now, Schlitzy was one of the inspirations behind Zippy the Pinhead. Another sideshow performer was Zip the What Is It, whose real name was William Henry Jackson, the same as your namesake, your great-grandfather, who is a celebrated photographer, William Henry Jackson.
That's right. About 5 years into doing Zippy, so 1975, I was visiting another cartoonist in San Francisco, and he had a book of circus history. So I was leafing through it, and I came to a page. It was a poster announcing Zip the What Is It's appearance in the Ringling Brothers Circus. At the bottom of it, there was a very brief bio of Zip the What Is It. I had never read a bio before. And it gave his name as William Henry Jackson, born in 1843 in New Jersey. I dropped the book on the floor. My name is William Henry Jackson Griffith, named after my great-grandfather, who was, yes, a celebrated photographer. Google him, you'll see. He was born in 1843.
Whoa.
In upstate New York, not New Jersey. Zip was a black man. My great-grandfather was a white man, but the connection was pretty cosmic. I felt if there was any doubt that I should be doing Zippy, that doubt was erased at that moment.
Well, Zippy the Pinhead is famous for his non sequiturs, but they're not pure non sequiturs. You have been definitely sending up popular culture and consumer culture and all kinds of odd philosophies for decades now.
Yeah. When I coined the phrase, "Are we having fun yet?" my intention was twofold. Zippy screamed it in a story in Arcade Comics Review, 1975. He screamed it while he was sliding down a banister and landing in the pool at the Hearst Castle in San Simeon, California. So he was already having fun, but he was actually asking, while having fun, he was asking if he was having fun. So it's like self-awareness and happiness at the same time. The phrase got popularized as just while you're having fun, you just yell, "Are we having fun yet?" meaning join me in my having fun moment. That's not at all what I intended, but I am given credit for it in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations.
Oh, good.
Yeah, which made my mother very happy.
William Randolph Hearst III took Zippy the Pinhead, the comic that was appearing weekly in alternative newspapers and monthly in the National Lampoon, and made it a daily strip. And that was back in the 1980s. And it went on to, and I'm sure you're at peace with this, it went on to be the strip that consistently rates near the bottom of readers' polls, readers of daily newspapers.
Yeah. Zippy doesn't go well with Beetle Bailey. on the other hand, whenever Zippy is canceled because of bad poll numbers, he's almost always reinstated within a month or two, because then his fans come out of the woodwork and they say, how could you do this? In other words, they don't respond to polls. You think editors would learn, but, you know, they come and go. So they don't have whatever it takes to be their own person. You know, they go by what they think the public wants. But anyway, yeah, William Randolph Hearst III in 1985 approached me, Robert Crumb, and Hunter Thompson, and asked all three of us, would we contribute to the new San Francisco Examiner, which he had just literally inherited from his uncle. The paper was not doing well, and they just figured it couldn't be any worse. Let's give it to Willie. And Willie took over the paper. Crumb did 20 strips with Aileen, his wife. They were so filthy that there was no possibility of them ever running. In other words, they sabotaged the deal on their own.
Uh-huh.
Hunter Thompson lasted a few weeks. His career at the Examiner ended in gunfire. He had been just not sending in his column for a number of weeks, so they flew him to San Francisco and put him up at the St. Francis Hotel. When Hearst approached the door of Hunter Thompson's room, bullets came flying out through the door. I saw the bullets later because there was a party that night.
So the legends about Hunter Thompson are just the starting point for the truth.
Yes. Yeah, I remember Hunter Thompson, I couldn't tell what he was doing. He was completely blotto, total drunk, whatever other drugs he was taking. But he came across as a Zippy hater in that party. I hate that strip. What the f*** is that all about? Yada, yada, yada. I guess he was provoking me into something, you know, some Hunter Thompson moment. I don't know what I said to him.
So is Zippy like the holy fool of medieval legend, of Zen Buddhism?
Yep, okay. Absolutely. Zippy is the wise fool. Zippy is the court jester. But in Zippy's case, he's not acting. He's as if the court jester never took off the costume, never just went to bed that night as a regular person. Zippy doesn't ever take off his costume. He's always Zippy. Early on in my career doing Zippy, also from probably 75 or 76, I did a story called Commedia del Zippy.
On the old Italian...
Based on Commedia dell'arte. And that was with the Commedia dell'arte players. They were these band of actors who would tour originally Italy, and then I think they went beyond. They went to France.
There was the Buffo, the Harlequin.
Right, these classic characters. And they would do these plays that were just a mockery of all authority. That was their purpose, really. Religious authority, the royalty, and I play Zippy in that tradition, definitely. Today we have stand-up comedians that perform that job, too. We allow a certain group of people in society to be unruly, to be outrageous, to say things that we all have in our heads but can't speak ourselves. And so, yes, Zippy also represents, remember the old hippie poster, question authority, you know, so Zippy is firmly in that tradition too. Sort of a relationship between someone at a lower level of power and society mocking someone at a higher level of power and authority. That's where most humor comes from, yes.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Konser. And my guest today is graphic novelist, comic strip artist, and Zippy the Pinhead creator, Bill Griffith. Now, give us some of the cast of characters of the Zippy the Pinhead comic. There's Zippy, of course, and then there's Griffy, who is your alter ego and kind of the straight man.
Yeah, and Griffy came about through a conversation I had with Art Spiegelman. This was back in 1974, when we were both living in San Francisco and doing comics. I remember Art said to me that he really liked the Zippy character and what I was doing with it, but And I said, oh, God, there's a but coming. He said, but it's kind of like being stuck in an elevator with a crazy person. You're waiting for your floor to come up so you can get out of the elevator. And I laughed and took it well, I thought. I went home that night and said, uh-oh, has Zippy reached some sort of dead end? He's so off the wall and weird. Where am I going to take it next? And that's where Griffey was born. I mean, I probably didn't think of it that night, but within a week or two, I thought he needs a sidekick, a very, very different person. And who could that be? So I made it me. Whereas Zippy, he has no filter. He says whatever comes into his head. Griffey is always analyzing everything. He's critical. He's insecure. He's Zippy's opposite. And so, you know, comedy teams often happen that way. Abbott and Costello or whatever, the goofball and the more kind of an authority figure, the child and the adult, you know. So Zippy is a child and I'm the adult. And that let me keep doing Zippy, because then Zippy became much more of a vehicle for satire.
You've been heavily influenced by the surrealists, the Dada artists, like proto-surrealist playwright Alfred Jarry, who was the author of Ubu Roy. His whole life, he was kind of a dangerous lunatic. He was a genius, but he was a hazard to everybody around him.
Alfred Jarry's best creation was himself. It's too bad there's no film of it, but there's plenty of records of people who saw him, including Picasso, who talks about him in it was a letter, I think. Yeah, Alfred Jarry was an avant-garde playwright, turn of the 20th century Paris. You could call him a surrealist, but I think he was more Dada or absurd more than surreal. He was famous for having his tie was painted onto his shirt, and he carried a gun wherever he went. And if you asked him for a light for your cigarette, he would take out the gun and blow the end off your cigarette. I mean, now he would be arrested for that today, but that was considered very absurd and weird at the time. I think Jarry was probably the real thing. He was an author and he was an artist, and some of what he was doing was for, it was like performance art in a way, but I think he was also just a little nutty, and more than a little nutty, and that this was his natural instinct to be this way. He spoke in a machine gun manner. Every syllable had the same emphasis. He went around town on a bicycle, which he occasionally rode backwards. So he was, I read about him in a book called The Banquet Years, which was all about that period of time, Picasso and Guillaume Apollinaire and Henri Rousseau. And what I got out of it was Jarry as a cartoon character, that Jarry himself, he was his own art. Unfortunately, he was addicted to absinthe, so he died fairly young, because that will rot your brain. But yeah, he was a major influence.
Well, when you began your cartooning career, and people forget that you were really one of the earliest of the underground cartoonists, your influences were very literary. You included Alfred Jarry in your comics, of course, but also Mr. Toad, a sort of a warped version of the Wind in the Willows character, became a mainstay.
Yeah, I read Wind in the Willows when I was a kid, and then I rediscovered it again, I would say about 1964.
And Mr. Toad is such an agent of chaos.
Yes. He's an egomaniac. He's a disruptor. He's a mischief maker. And I wanted to be a disruptor and a mischief maker, so I loved Mr. Toad in The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. I started doing drawings of him, watercolors mostly, and just little quotes below it. This was not comics, but it was, you could call it proto-comics. In 64, so that was way before I started doing comics. In 68, when I did my first comics, I was still enamored of Mr. Toad, who I was then calling Mr. The Toad, to differentiate him from The Wind in the Willows, Mr. Toad. So Mr. The Toad. So my very first comics, he was my main character. I still have him appear regularly in the Zippy Daily Strip. He's a very powerful character to me. But once again, as where I had to make Zippy stop being just a loose cannon and be more interesting, having, you know, more to do, more with his relationship with Griffey. When I brought Mr. Toad back, starting whenever, the 90s, I decided to make him just this dark character. So the first, when I first restarted doing the Toad, he was sitting in a bar in the shadows, just sort of slightly emerging from the shadows. And he was spouting aphorisms about life and absolute certainty about things and, you know, kind of a little bit like William Burroughs or something like that. And that brought him back. Now I use him quite often. And I'm glad, because you can't really kill a comic strip character. They always come back to life at some point. And if they come back to life in a way that works again, then that's gold. You know, that's wonderful. So I think Mr. Toad, he's still who he was to a degree when I started him, but he has evolved.
Now I'm going to hear his voice as William S. Burroughs all the time. I don't know what it is about amphibians, but, you know, Jim Woodring has all these nightmarish frogs as well in his work.
I trace it back to Froggy the Gremlin, who was a character in a 1950s kids show called The Andy Devine Show, which was very crude folk art kind of show.
Pluck your magic twanger, Froggy.
Pluck your magic twanger. So in that case, Froggy was just this disruptive character who would come in. Like Andy Devine would go, "And now, kids, I want you all to," and then Froggy would say, "Put it on your head." And he would take a pie and put it on his head, you know. So Froggy was this evil, lurking, dark creature that would represented your darkest impulses that wanted to take over. And that's really where Mr. the Toad started, and then Wind in the Willows and whatever, and then, yeah.
Another really influential underground cartoonist that just happens to be your spouse, Diane Newman. The two of you have written numerous Zippy the Pinhead film scripts. Early on, I can remember back, I think in the 80s, that Randy Quaid was tapped to play the title character of Zippy.
Yes, starting in early 80s, I got the first feeler from Hollywood about a Zippy movie. It was from a guy who was just a lawyer. He sent me a check for $500 and suggested that I just give him the right to make a Zippy movie. I looked at the back of the check, and there was a paragraph that said I had given him all rights in perpetuity throughout the universe to Zippy the Pinhead. So I'd never...
Throughout the universe, even Zippy's home planet.
Yes. It did literally say that, throughout the universe. So I didn't send the check back. I did take a meeting with him, just because I thought it would be entertaining, in his Malibu mansion. And that was the beginning. But that, it obviously didn't go anywhere. But then I began to get more just realer type requests to explore the idea of a Zippy screenplay. And over the period of from the mid-80s up until 2000, 2001, there was always something brewing that never quite gelled. And yes, Randy Quaid agreed to be Zippy at one point. In fact, he would have been a great Zippy. He would call up sometime out of the blue and do Zippy voices. he and his brother did a magic act. So he could do magic acts.
His brother Dennis?
Yes. They did. They were from Texas. They did a magic act as teenagers, you know, performed, not just in the garage. So one time I had a lunch with him, and he showed me that he could do magic tricks, just the most obvious magic tricks. So I thought that was great. I thought, well, Zippy can do magic tricks unexpectedly. He was unfortunately, Randy Quaid was not bankable. He was never bankable. We would always get what they call elements of the thing together. We had a screenplay, we had Randy Quaid, but we didn't have a bankable director or a co-star or producer. And so we never really got, you know, to the point where it gained traction, although it did get pretty close. I remember we were once associated with Michael Nesmith, Pacific Film Arts, it was called, Michael Nesmith of the Monkees. I remember we had a meeting with him, and he was gung-ho. He was going to...
This was after he had produced Repo Man.
Yes. He was going to spearhead the Zippy movie, and we had a meeting at a big boardroom table where he had his company. And at the end of the meeting, he said to everybody at the table, including me, he said, now remember, let's submerge, but don't lose sight of the donut. And everybody nodded, like, oh, right, right. Only now do I really quite understand what he meant. I think he just meant go deep, but don't lose sight of the fact that this is an absurd character. But at the time, I just nodded with everybody else. He spoke in metaphors all the time, a lot of sports metaphors.
It sounded like it should be a Zippy phrase.
I've used it. I've used it, yes. I always said yes to a meeting in Hollywood because I got strips out of it.
Mining material.
Yes, we had a meeting with Disney that the same thing happened. They said, we want to make the Zippy movie. I said, have you read the script? They said, yeah, the script is right here. It looks great. We have one problem. I said, okay, what's the problem? So here's me sabotaging this meeting. They said, the stubble. You know, we see one of the prime places to exploit Zippy would be as a greeter at Disney World and Disneyland, as the big head type greeters. And we're concerned that the stubble might frighten small children. Would it be like little round dots of black? Would they extrude out from his face? And what I was supposed to say was, lose the stubble. There is no stubble. Zippy doesn't have stubble. Instead, I said, this is in late 80s or whatever, I said, you know, Don Johnson, Miami Vice, he has stubble. And it's kind of cool and hip to have stubble. Once again, we were in the elevator and in the parking lot, and that was the end of that. Yeah.
That sounds every bit as random as a Zippy strip.
Yes. I am actually very grateful there was no movie and no TV show because I think they would have destroyed Zippy. But I just got loads of material from these. I never turned down a meeting because they always involved these wonderful butting of heads moments, you know, where they didn't understand me and I didn't want to be part of them. But I was supposed to do a certain, you know, I was supposed to bend over, and I never did. So it was always fun.
You were having fun.
I was having fun yet.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been graphic novelist and comic strip artist, Bill Griffith. Bill, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
It was my pleasure.
Now, for our listeners who want to keep up with all of your projects, how can they find out more?
Just go to zippythepinhead.com and you'll see everything.
Well, many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at kboo.fm. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
Got a brand new suit, got a brand new tie, got a brand new twinkle in my eye. You must know the reason why I got a brand new girl, and I won't dispute. She's the reason why I got a brand new tie and a brand new suit when I'm with her. Gotta look my best, put on my tan shoes, dress fast, double-breasted vest. Latch on and get that stick, miss. It's Peg LaPearl with the brand new tie, the brand new